thank you so much. Yeah, as I was saying, I really wish I could be there in person to visit Perimeter. And I really enjoyed my past visits. It's just that this semester is a little bit hectic for me, but I do hope that in the near future, I'll be able to visit you guys in person. So the title of the talk today is Symmetry Lost and Found. I hope as the talk proceeds, it will become clear why I chose this title, but it will be about non-invertible symmetry. And I apologize in advance that some of you might have heard the first half or some version of the first half of the talk, but I hope that I will still be able to keep you entertained. So this is based on several papers I wrote with my collaborators. In the talk today, I will mostly focus on these three papers from last year, which were written together with my longtime collaborator, Ho-Tao Lam from MIT, and my PhD student, Yi-Cho Choi at Stony Brook, which has really been the driving force for all these papers. He's really amazing. So I'll start the talk with a very familiar story, the chiral symmetry in QED, in 3 plus 1D QED. So consider QED with a massless unit charge Dirac fermion in the U1 gauge group. The Lagrangian is given as follows. It's probably the second Lagrangian we have ever encountered in any quantum field theory textbooks. Classically, the Lagrangian has a chiral symmetry, as is well known. It rotates the fermion in the following way. Importantly, there's a gamma 5 matrix in the rotation. Here, psi is the Dirac fermion, which has both the left and the right moving component. The factor of 2, don't worry about it too much. It's just we normalize our alpha in such a way that when alpha is 2 pi, this becomes minus 1, and that's part of the gauge group. So alpha should be identified with alpha plus 2 pi, but don't worry about the factor of 2. Now, famously, this classical symmetry in the Lagrangian fails to be a healthy global symmetry quantum mechanically. And that's a phenomenon known as anomaly, discovered by Adler, Bell, and Jacquive back in 1969. The ABJ anomaly was discovered in the context of the U1 problem to explain the neutral pion decay, pi zero decay into two photons. And the discoverer of the anomaly successfully determined the couplings between the neutral pion and the photons in the chiral Lagrangian. And that explains the dominant decay rate of the neutral pion into two photons. So that was a beautiful story back then, but there's something I would say just very, very slightly counterintuitive. Usually we celebrate when we discover the existence of a global symmetry. ABJ anomaly, on the other hand, states that there isn't a global symmetry that one would have naively expected. So how come we can derive all these quantitative results from the absence of a global symmetry rather than the presence thereof? Of course, in the real world, since the fine structure constant is small, we can treat it as treat the electromagnetic gauge field as background. Then one can understand the pi zero FF turn in the chiral Lagrangian from the standard Tu-Hoff anomaly matching argument for a global symmetry in that limit. Oh, hello, Davide. But wouldn't it be nice if we can reinterpret this classic result from the existence of a generalized global symmetry? And that's part of the motivation for this series of work. And let me mention this interesting fact that in 1999, there's a conference at IIS celebrating Steve Adler's 60th birthday. And the title of the conference is Symmetry Found and Lost, which is the reverse of the title of the talk today. And it refers to the fact that chiral symmetry was very useful in constraining the chiral Lagrangian, but then in 69, Adler, Bell, and Jacquive showed that it's actually not there quantum mechanically, and hence the name Found and Lost. And if you go around and ask people, is chiral symmetry a symmetry in massless QED, you really get a diverse set of responses. And let me just record some of them on this slide. The first answer would be, no, it's not the symmetry, period. That's the whole point of ABJ. Classically, there's a symmetry, but quantum mechanically, it's not. Now, some other people would say, yes, it is a symmetry, but only in flat space time. And that's totally correct. The anomaly, the symmetry is anomalous because it will be violated by instant time. However, if the gauge group is U1, such as in the case for QED, there's no abelian instanton in flat space time. Therefore, even though there's an anomaly, there isn't an instanton that does the job to violate it if you only look at flat space time scattering amplitudes of electrons and positrons. Then, after this, there are even more confusing answers. Sometimes people say, yes, it's a symmetry, but it's not gauge invariant. Yes, it's a symmetry, but it's an anomalous symmetry, so and so on. The list continues. But there isn't quite a straight answer because something is conserved, despite the fact that there isn't a true, honest-to-God global symmetry quantum mechanical. Nonetheless, the helicity of electron and positrons is conserved in any scattering amplitudes of just electrons and positrons. But you cannot quite explain it using a true global symmetry. So is there a straight answer to this question? And that's another motivation for the talk today. Now, before I go into the details, let me just give away the upshot. The upshot is that we'll show that the continuous invertible chiral symmetry of QED, which is there in the classical Lagrangian, it's not completely broken by the ABJ anomaly. In fact, from a modern point of view, it's resurrected as a discrete and non-invertible global symmetry, which I will later explain. There's a similar construction in QCD as well, and that results in the coupling term pi zero FF, which is necessary to match this non-invertible global symmetry. So we have turned around the traditional argument of deriving the pi zero FF in terms of matching of a generalized global symmetry. And therefore, one could say that the neutral pion decay in the real world can be understood in terms of a non-invertible global symmetry. So that will be the focus of the first half of the talk. In the second half of the talk, I will mention some other application in physics involving axion. So before we talk about generalized global symmetry, let's start with conventional symmetry in the spirit of Noether. So we start with a conserved Noether current satisfying the conservation equation. We can then take the time component of the current, integrate it over the whole space to get a conserved charge. The charge is conserved because if you hit it with a derivative, you can convert it into a total derivative in the integrand. Assuming appropriate boundary condition, this vanishes, and hence the charge is invariant under time evolution. You can further exponentiate the charge to get a symmetry operator, which is a unitary operator. And this is what I call U theta, with theta labeling the U1 rotation angle. Now, for relativistic systems in Euclidean signature, the time direction is on the same footing as any other spatial direction. We can therefore integrate the current on a general closed 3 manifold M with a superscript 3 to denote the fact that it's a 3 manifold in our 4-dimensional Euclidean space-time. In the previous slide, we talked about U theta, which is the integral of JT, the time component of the current, over the whole space. That gives you an operator acting on the Hilbert space. That corresponds to the picture here, where you picture the horizontal direction as space. I simplified the spatial dimension to be only one dimensional and shown by a circle. The vertical direction is time. If you integrate JT at a fixed time over the whole space, that gives you an operator acting on the Hilbert space. But in a relativistic setup, you can take J mu to integrate it over any 3 manifold. For instance, you can integrate it over the 3 manifold at a fixed x. Then the integral runs this direction along the time direction in particular. In this case, this is not an operator, it's a defect. It changes the quantization of your theory. Originally, your fields might be periodic as it goes around the x direction. Now you might pick up a twisted boundary condition. You might get a phase as it goes around the circle. For instance, when theta is pi, originally start with a periodic boundary condition. After inserting the defect, you get an anti-periodic boundary condition. Phi becomes minus phi as it goes around the circle. More generally, you get this interesting object, u theta of m, that depends on the choice of the three manifold in your four-dimensional space-time. Previously, the operator u theta, without the argument, is an operator, and it's conserved, meaning that if we hit it with a time derivative, it doesn't change any correlation function. But conservation, the word conserved, should now be upgraded in a relativistic setup. It's upgraded to the fact that this new object u theta of n depends on the choice of the three manifold only topologically, meaning that if you deform this manifold m a little bit, it's not going to change any correlation function, and that's just a simple consequence from the divergence theorem. So the upshot of this slide and the previous one is that the notion of conservation for ordinary global symmetry should be upgraded to the notion of topological in a relativistic quantum field theory. Now let's go back to QED and see what's going on. In QED, we can define a chiral or axial current, JA, in terms of the fermion bilinears. Famously, it obeys the anomalous conservation equation. So the divergence of JA is no longer zero, but equals F wedge F, where F is the field strength for the dynamical gauge field, normalizing such a manner. Starting from this anomalous conservation equation, we would like to define a conserved, or more generally, topological quantity. Our first trial will be just to take the star of JA and integrate it over any three manifold M. However, this operator, U alpha, is not conserved, or more generally, not topological, because it does not obey the ordinary conservation equation. It's not a closed form. So if you deform it a little bit, it generally picks up a contribution from the integral of F wedge F. Adler, in his 1969 paper, defined a symmetry operator that is formally conserved, but not gauge invariant. So what did he do? He shifts the star of JA by a Chern-Simons term ADA and integrated over a three manifold. Alpha here labels the chiral rotation angle. Let's call this operator U hat alpha. This operator, however, is not gauge invariant because the Chern-Simons term does not come with a properly quantized coefficient. Here, let me make a technical comment that I'm going to assume every manifold to be a spin manifold. That's just to simplify my life. And if you are on spin manifolds, then it's a true fact that the Chern-Simons action is only gauge invariant if the coefficient n here is an integer. If you compare this fact with the red term in this u hat operator, the coefficient here is alpha over a pi square, and alpha can be anything between 0 and 2 pi. It could be pi over square root 7, for instance. And therefore, this term, this red Lagrange, red term, violates the gauge invariance under large gauge transformation. So that was the status back in 69. You either have a gauge invariant operator u alpha, which is not conserved, or you have a formally conserved operator u hat that is not gauge invariant. Since it's not gauge invariant, I don't know what I'm talking about, and that's why I put it in quotation marks. And I will use this scheme later on throughout the talk. Whenever something is not gauge invariant and ill-defined, I will put them in quotation marks, and those expressions are waiting to be corrected later on. To proceed, let's be less ambitious. let's say we specialize our chiral rotation angle alpha to be a fraction, 2 pi over n. N could be any integer, 7, 13, 29, up to you. And then we plug in this value of alpha back into this problematic operator u hat. Now the red term, the problematic term, becomes 1 over 4 pi n ABA, which is still not good because remember, the Chern-Simons action, the Chern-Simons action is only gauge invariant if the coefficient here is an integer over 4 pi. Here, the integer is in the denominator, so we didn't fix the issue yet. It's a fractional Chern-Simons term. Fortunately, this term, this problematic term, which again, notice that I put it in quotation marks, made an appearance in a different context, in the context of fractional quantum Hall effects. There, the system is 2 plus 1D. It's a tabletop experiment. The space is two-dimensional, and we have a time direction. In that context, this red action is commonly used to describe the nu equals to 1 over n fractional quantum Hall effect. In that context, n is the 2 plus 1 space-time, 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time where you perform the fractional quantum Hall experiment. Recall that in the previous slide, this n is the support of the operator slash defect we want to define in the 3 plus 1D QED. But forget about QED and focus on the fractional quantum Hall for this slide. In that context, this is used as an effective action. However, it's not gauge invariant for the problem we just said. There's a well-known fix. The more precise and gauge invariant Lagrangian for the fractional quantum Hall effect is this blue action, where we have introduced an additional dynamical gauge field little a. This little a lives on M. And the relation between the blue action and the red action is that if you formally integrate out little a, you get this relation. And if you substitute little a back into the blue action, you retrieve the red action. However, there are many things that go wrong with this operation. Both little a and capital A are properly quantized gauge field. By properly quantized, I mean capital A has to obey the its field strength has to obey this quantization condition. Since both little a and capital A obey the appropriate quantization condition, it doesn't make sense to divide a properly quantized gauge field by an integer. And indeed, you don't expect the red action and the blue action to be related by a legal manipulation. After all, the red action is gauge non-invariant and the blue action is gauge invariant. You can only relate the legal action to an illegal one by doing some illegal manipulation. And that's why I put this the first line, the third line in quotation marks. At any rate, in the context of fractional quantum Hall state, the blue action is the more precise gauge invariant Lagrangian. You see that all the coefficients in front of the Chern-Simons terms are properly quantized. Now, motivated by this discussion in the fractional quantum Hall, we decided to replace this problematic term in U hat of QED by the blue action. So now we have come back to QED and have just defined for you a new operator that I call D with a subscript 1 over N. In defining this D, I have to introduce a path integral over an auxiliary field little a that only lives on the support of this operator, m. This little a is completely stuck on the operator, d. It doesn't lead to any new asymptotic state in our 3 plus 1d QED. All the asymptotic states are still the electrons, positrons, and photons. You can think about little a just as an auxiliary field. Its main purpose in life is to make this imprecise gauge non-invariant expression gauge invariant. So we have this new operator. It's gauge invariant because all the transignment coefficients are now properly quantized. Furthermore, it's a conserved quantity. And more generally, it's topological. This requires a more detailed analysis, which we did in the paper, but let me not do it in during the talk. I'll be happy to talk about it more after the talk if you are interested in the precise argument. At a hand waving level, you can say that, oh, maybe I'll just formally integrate a little a, then I go back to this imprecise Lagrangian where the topological nature is manifest. But there's a much better way to do it, much more rigorous way to do it. So it seems that we have succeeded in what we wanted to achieve in the first place. We started with the anomalous conservation equation of the axial current in QED, and we were searching for a conserved quantity. And indeed, we obtained this D, which is both gauge invariant and conserved. The trick we use is to dress the operator by a 2 plus 1D fractional quantum Hall state. So at the level of the slogan, you can say that the fractional quantum Hall state cures the ABJ anomaly of 3 plus 1D QED. Any question at this point? Please feel free to interrupt me during the talk. All right? If not, let me proceed. But there's no free lunch in theoretical physics. The price we pay for this operator is that even though it's conserved, it's not a unitary operator. How do we see that it's not unitary? Well, that's easy. We just multiply d with d dagger. And that's an easy calculation to do. We basically just multiply this expression with its dagger. But importantly, for each d or d dagger, there's the auxiliary path integral we have to perform. One of them I call dA, the other I call dA bar. And you collect the terms together, you get this complicated expression taking the form of a transignment action. I'll come back to the meaning of this term in just one sec, but at this point, it suffices to know that the right-hand side of d times d dagger is not an identity operator. And therefore, d is not a unitary operator. You can even argue that it's not only not unitary, but also it's not invertible. It doesn't have an inverse. This operator D has a kernel on certain Hilbert spaces. So what is this thing on the right-hand side that we were hoping to be one, but turned out not to be the case? It involves three different fields. It involves the little a bar, and the capital A. Let me remind you, capital A is the dynamical bulk electromagnetic gauge field. It's the ordinary gauge field that we study in QED. Little a and little a bar are just auxiliary fields that are stuck on the manifold where the operators are supported on. So imagine if you are able to integrate out little a and little a bar in a local way, which I don't know how, and it's probably impossible, but imagine you think about them as just an auxiliary field. Then at the end of the day, this whole object, which we call C, is just some function, some operator that depends on dA, d capital A. What is d capital A? D capital A is the magnetic field. So this C operator is trying its very best to be some integral of the magnetic field. What would be such an operator? Well, that's easy. In electromagnetism, of when we learn in undergraduate, we can take the integral of magnetic field over a tube surface. That's just the magnetic flux operator. But this one is not the magnetic flux operator because we are doing some kind of integral of the magnetic field over a three manifold M. Recall that M is three dimensional. So it's kind of like a magnetic flux operator through a three manifold rather than a two manifold. And it turns out that such a thing does exist, and it's known as the condensation defect in the recent literature. It started its life in condensed matter physics And it has now propagated into math and high energy physics. I'm not going to say too much about the details of what we mean, what is a condensation defect and why it is called a condensation defect. The terminology has a very long history that I'm not going to justify. But roughly speaking, it comes from a more generalized gauging procedure you can perform on a higher form symmetry. In this case, the relevant higher form symmetry is the U1 magnetic one form symmetry of QED, under which the monopole is charged under. That's all I wanted to say about the condensation defect. It's another kind of non-invertible symmetry. It's a little bit boring. The interesting player is really the operator D here. In any case, the take-home message of this slide is just that D times D dagger is not one. So let's summarize what we have talked about so far. In QED, you can have a gauge invariant operator that's not conserved, so we don't know what it is good for, or you can have a U hat operator that is not gauge invariant but conserved. Finally, we define this operator D that is both gauge invariant and conserved. The only price we pay is that it's not an invertible symmetry. But it's a feature, not a bug. Previously, we applied this construction for chiral rotation of the form 2 pi over n. It's very easy to generalize it to any rational angle where p and n are two coprime integers. All you have to do is to replace the TQFT here by certain Zn TQFT. I'll refer you guys to this very nice reference defining the minimal Zn TQFT. The details don't matter. I'm not going to say too much about the general rational number case. But to summarize, in QED, what we have found is that the classical continuous invertible symmetry, U1 chiral symmetry, is broken by the ABJ anomaly to a discrete non-invertible global symmetries. This D with a subscript P over N, labeled by the rational number. And this operator fits into a bigger story of non-invertible symmetry, which has seen a lot of developments in the past few years. The reference should really go back to decades ago, maybe even to the 60s when people study integrable system, or later on when Moore and Seiberg talk about rational conformal field theory and Verlinde. But in recent years, this non-invertible symmetries have been organized into this bigger framework of generalized global symmetry. And here I just made a very, very small partial list of references that have that are relevant in the past few years. These are symmetries that are not implemented by unitary operators. It is still conserved. It leads to interesting selection rules, but it lies outside the paradigm of group theory. Even though it sounds weird, it's actually discovering a wide variety of quantum systems, including the Ising model, in which case it's the Kramer's Wernier duality defect, and also the axion system, which I will talk about later on in this talk, and also in QED and QCD. In the case of the Ising model, this is arguably the simplest kind of non-invertible symmetry. It's implemented by a topological line. What it does is that when you bring it past through the older operator of the Ising CFT, the older operator becomes a disorder operator attached to the Z2 branch cut. And so it implements the Kramer's Wernier duality. I also want to say that non-invertible symmetry is not something that only exists in the fantasy of a high-energy physicist's mind. It has many lattice realization, including the anionic chains studied by these people. In 1 plus 1D, the finite non-invertible symmetries are described by the mathematical theory of fusion category. In higher dimensions, the mathematical language for non-invertible symmetries, I would say, is still under development. It's believed to be described by some higher fusion category. And there was this very nice paper last year making progress in how to phrase all these new symmetries in this bigger categorical framework. But I will not use the any category in the rest of the world, in the rest of the talk. I think one exciting aspect of this research program is that I think the physics is a little bit ahead of the math. Now, we're just physicists. We play with Lagrangian, we play with operator, we play with fields, and we can define all kinds of operator obeying interesting fusion rules such as this one. But the mathematical framework behind is still under development. And I think it's a really exciting time to be working on this subject, where I get insight from not just physicists, but also from mathematicians. But
sorry, what do you mean with unitary here?
What do I mean by unitary here?
Yes.
Yeah. So by unitary operator, I mean it's an operator whose dagger, where there's a dagger such that u times u dagger is one.
Okay, you mean it's just invertible?
Well, it's stronger than invertible, right? A unitary matrix is invertible, but not the other way around.
No, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's easier to explain why it's not unitary. For the reason why it's non-invertible requires a little bit more argument. That's why I use unitary here. And I also want to make connection to the statement that, you know, Wigner's theorem stated that every symmetry in quantum mechanics should be implemented by a unitary or an anti-unitary operator. But that's in the context of quantum mechanics. In quantum field theory, it has been argued that the notion of symmetry should really be generalized beyond unitary operators. Yeah, thanks for the question. Any other questions? All right. But you can legitimately ask, all right, we have some conserved operators in QED, in Ising-Hofmann field theory. They're conserved, they are topological. They're interesting, they're useful, but why should we think about them as symmetries? We should think about symmetry as some kind of a prestigious, you know, group of concepts. And now there's a new concept comes along. Why should we include it into this bigger family of symmetries? Now, this might be a question of semantics, but let me give a few arguments that why we should include it as a new kind of symmetry. First of all, these new non-invertible conserved operators, they lead to conservation laws and selection rules. So they give similar consequences as ordinary global symmetries. Second, some of the non-invertible global symmetries can be gauged just like an ordinary global symmetry. This has been fully developed in 1 plus 1D for finite non-invertible symmetries, and partially developed in 2 plus 1D, especially for one-form symmetry in 2 plus 1D. But generally, it's not known how to do the gauging. But in some cases, there are many examples. Third, some other non-invertible symmetries cannot be gauged. And when there's an obstruction to gauging them, they can have generalized anomalies, just like ordinary global symmetries. And this generalized anomalies lead to generalized Tu-Hoff anomaly matching condition, leading to new constraints on renormalization group flows. And the fourth argument, which I also really like, is that this inclusion of the non-invertible symmetry into this bigger family of symmetries consolidates different conjectures in quantum gravity. And here's one example. In quantum gravity, there are two pieces of lore that people believe are true, and they have been proven in some specialized contexts. The first one is that it's believed that there's no true global symmetry in quantum gravity. All global symmetries have to be broken or to be gauged as you go to the Planck scale. Second, while there's no global symmetry in quantum gravity, there could be a gauge symmetry in quantum gravity. And when there is a gauge symmetry in quantum gravity, we expect that the gauge spectrum to be complete, meaning that you should have all representations of the gauge group possible in your particle spectrum. There's a third piece of lore stating that the
so, how do you know if something has a gauge symmetry?
How do I know if something is a gauge symmetry? Is that a question?
Yes, or has a gauge symmetry.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. So on complete general grounds, I think the answer is I don't know. Right, and I think all these conjectures, especially the completeness hypothesis, relies more on a weakly coupled Einstein gravity limit. Otherwise, I totally agree with you that it doesn't make much sense.
It's not about gravity, it's about the symmetries. Unless you have infrared gauge fields, how would you talk about the gauge symmetry?
I think you do have to assume that there are infrared gauge fields.
But then how would you talk about the generalized gauge symmetry?
Well, we can talk about higher form symmetries. Why is that?
Okay, but these are not gauge symmetry. No, okay.
Here by gauge symmetry, so far this gauge is an ordinary gauge symmetry. You know, it could be U1, it could be Zn. It's not about higher form yet. On the other side of the conjecture, there could be generalized global symmetry. But I agree with you. I think that's why I call them pieces of lore, because I don't know how to phrase them in a completely rigorous way. But I think these are conjectures that are made based on observation of quantum gravity, which emits a low energy limit that does have a long range gauge field interpretation. Now, any other question? All right. There's a third piece of lore which states that the previous two pieces of lore should be equivalent in the context already in quantum field theory. But it's easy to see that they're not equivalent if you do not include more generalized global symmetry. And the inclusion of the non-invertible global symmetry can make the two statements on the same footing when you make some mild assumptions. So that I will say is the fourth argument why we should include them into the bigger this family of global symmetries. All right. So coming back to QED, we have introduced this infinitely many new operators D, and let's see what it tells us. The operators D, it acts invertibly on the fermion fields, just as a chiral rotation with a rational angle. So that's pretty boring. It just acts in the naive way you would have expected from a chiral symmetry. It gets interesting when you try to act the operator D on the two Hooft lines. So here's a picture that demonstrates the action. As you bring this non-invertible defect, this non-invertible symmetry D, past the two Hooft line, the two Hooft line is no longer a line operator anymore. It becomes a line operator attached to a surface. And this surface is a fractional magnetic flux. Is an integral of F over this blue surface. So the fact that it maps the line operators, a genuine line operators, into something that is not a genuine line operator is the hallmark that is a non-invertible symmetry. Now, because it acts invertibly on the fermions as a chiral rotations, if it only cares about scattering amplitudes that involve the electrons and the positrons, then this operator D just gives you the ordinary selection rules. In particular, it implies that the helicity of electrons and positrons have to be conserved in QED. But the moment you start talking about monopoles, then this you can no longer rely on the chiral symmetry. You have to deal with the non-invertible symmetry. Indeed, it is well known that in the scattering between a fermion with the monopole, the helicity is no longer conserved. And one way to understand it is because the non-invertible symmetry acts in a non-trivial way on the monopole, namely the two Hooft line. Let me make a comparison between this picture with the picture in the Ising model. In the Ising model, we have a non-invertible parameters 1-year defect. In 3 plus 1D QED, there's a non-invertible chiral symmetry. Sorry, my light was just turned off. Both non-invertible symmetries are tied to an ordinary global symmetry. Here I use colloquially the word tied, but I can make that even more precise if I have time. But let me not try to do that. It's somewhat similar to group extension or to higher group. But let me not make too much of it, too big a deal here. In the Ising case, the ordinary symmetry where this Kramer's one-year duality defect is tied to is the ordinary Z2 symmetry. It's the spin flip symmetry. In the context of 3 plus 1 DQED, is the magnetic 1-4 symmetry. In Ising CFT, the Kramer's one-year duality defect acts invertibly on the thermal operator. Similarly, the non-invertible chiral symmetry in QED acts invertibly on the fermion fields. In Ising, the Kramer's one-year duality defects act non-invertibly on the older operator. By non-invertibly, I mean it transforms a local operator, sigma, into a non-local operator, mu. Mu is non-local because even though it's a point in spacetime, it's secretly attached to a Z2 branch cut. Similarly, the non-invertible chiral symmetries turns the Tu-Hoff line operator, which is a general line operator in spacetime, into something that's connected to a topological surface. Let me make one more comment on the consequence of the non-invertible chiral symmetry in QED, and that's in the spirit of naturalness, a la Tu-Hoff. Tu-Hoff said, impose a global symmetry G, then the Lagrangian should include all G invariant terms with coefficients of order one with no fine tuning. Let's take the massless QED Lagrangian. What is the symmetry that forbids you from turning on a electron mass term? The naive answer will be the chiral symmetry. But then ABJ will come along and say, no, the chiral symmetry is not a symmetry. You cannot use it to make argument about naturalness. But now that we have established the fact that there is a non-invertible global symmetry in QED, we can say that the electron mass term is forbidden by if you impose the non-invertible global symmetry. And therefore, the electron is naturally massless in QED because of this non-invertible symmetry. This is to be contrasted with the scalar QED case, where there's really no enhanced global symmetry at the massless point. And that's related to the fact that there's a Coleman-Weinberg mechanism in scalar QED, saying that even if you start with the massless scalar QED, classically, quantum mechanically, a mass will be generated. But that's not the case for fermion QED. Along this line of discussion, it will be interesting to see how Tu-Hoff thought about it in the 80s. So let's take a quick look. This is his paper from the 80s. And the title of a section in that paper is called Naturalness in QED. And he said, QED is natural. And the relevant symmetry here is the chiral symmetry. But we need not be concerned about the ABJ anomaly because the photon field being abelian cannot acquire non-trivial topological 1D numbers. And that's a totally correct statement because there's no instant abelian instanton in flat space-time. For most of the purposes, you don't have to be worried about the anomaly. And here we give an alternative interpretation in terms of this non-invertible global symmetry, which is conserved in more general topology. So now we can make a little timeline for the fate of the chiral symmetry. Before 69, everyone thought the chiral symmetry is a symmetry. After 69, we realized it's not really a symmetry quantum mechanical. But since last year, we provided an alternative interpretation to interpret the chiral symmetry as a non-invertible global symmetry. So that's why I call the title of my talk is Symmetry Lost and Found. And it's interesting to look back in history. Back in 69, there was no way that ABJ will come up with this non-invertible symmetry. That is because the way we cured the ABJ anomaly was to use the fractional quantum Hall state, which was only discovered in 1982, 13 years after the ABJ papers. Let me quickly comment on the QCD case. Below the electron weak scale, the massless QCD Lagrangian for the up and down quarks has a chiral global symmetries that's associated with the neutral pion. It suffers from an ABJ anomaly of this type. This is a global symmetry. It has an ABJ anomaly with the U1, E, and M. So by the exact same construction, we obtain all this non-invertible global symmetry in the UV QCD. Given that we have this non-invertible global symmetry in UV QCD, how does the IR pion Lagrangian capture this non-invertible global symmetry? Well, let's look at the pion Lagrangian and focus on the neutral pion term. And we include this pi zero FF term with a general coupling G. The non-invertible global symmetry shifts the pion field. So in a way, the neutral pion is behaving like a Gossam boson for the non-invertible global symmetry. In the next slide, I will show that the equations of motion in the presence of the non-invertible global symmetry fix the coefficient G here uniquely. And that gives the dominant contribution to the neutral pion decay. It's a very simple calculation. You start with the bulk Lagrangian of the neutral pion, and you insert your non-invertible symmetry defect, say at x equals to zero. So now in this defect configuration, we solve the equation of motion. There are three fields. There's a neutral pion field. There's a bulk electromagnetic gauge field, capital A. And there's a dynamical auxiliary field, little a, that only lives on M. We can write down their equations of motions. And by staring at them for 5 seconds, you recognize that they are only compatible with each other if the coupling constant G takes this value. Conventionally, the pion decay was explained by the ABJ anomaly. But now we have provided an alternative explanation for the pion decay as a direct consequence from matching a non-invertible global symmetry in the UV QCD. So this has reinterpreted the famous result of ABJ in terms of the existence of a generalized global symmetry rather than the absence thereof. Let me quickly comment on some difficulty in extending our construction to more general cases. It's natural to ask, what if you apply our construction to chiral rotation with an irrational angle? And we don't know how to fix that. The simplest way to argue that is that there's no irrational quantum Hall state. But I do want to bring your attention to these two papers where they have an alternative construction. Another natural question is that our construction doesn't work for ABJ anomaly involving SUN gauge groups. The reason is because there's no magnetic one-form symmetry for SUN gauge groups. You can do it for PSUN, which was done by Clay and Contaro, but then you only get finitely many non-invertible symmetry. Finally, this construction also doesn't work for 1 plus 1D QED because there's no magnetic symmetry. In another paper in August, we generalized this construction to build non-invertible CP symmetry or non-invertible time reversal symmetry. We find that U1 gauge theory is time reversal invariant for every rational theta angle. So this is to be contrasted with the usual belief that you only have time reversal symmetry if theta is zero or pi. And here, this is the moduli space of the free Maxwell theory, and there's an interesting spectrum of non-invertible symmetry depending on where you are in the moduli space. In the final 10 minutes, I would like to talk about our most recent papers on non-invertible symmetries of axioms. The starting Lagrangian for us is this one, where theta is a dynamical axiom field. It's a 2 pi periodic scalar field. and it's coupled to the U1 gauge field via theta FHF. There's a coupling constant K, which has to be quantized. It was recognized in this papers that there's a higher group symmetry when K is greater than one. What we did in this paper is to show that for general K, in particular when K is one, there are non-invertible symmetries involving axions. And it gives a very nice interpretation of the Witten effect in terms of global symmetries. One of the non-invertible symmetries obvious is the one that shifts the theta, the axion field. It's related to the Petrin-Quinn symmetry. And it's basically, it follows the same construction we had for the neutral pion. After all, the neutral pion behaves like an axion field in the chiral Lagrangian. I will not say too much about that one because it basically follows the same construction. On the other hand, in the axion Maxwell theory, there's an additional non-invertible symmetry. It's a non-invertible one-form symmetry that has a lot to do with the Witten effect, as I will now explain. So let's take a look at the axion Maxwell. The Gauss law is anomalous in the sense that d star f doesn't vanish. D star f equals to something non-trivial. And because of the anomalous Gauss law, there's no conserved and quantized electric charge that can be measured by an ordinary Gauss law operator. And this is related to the Page charge discussed in the literature. One way to see that there's no conserved electric charge in axion physics is the following. Imagine you have an axion string that's going out of the screen. You can create a monopole and an anti-monopole pair out of the vacuum. It costs you a lot of energy, but let's say you insert a lot of energy to initiate such a process. And then you bring the monopole and anti-monopole around the axion string. Famously, as Witten argued, when you bring a magnetically charged object around, when you tune the theta angle from 0 to 2 pi, in the presence of a magnetically charged object, the monopole will acquire an electric charge. That's the famous Witten effect. As the monopole goes around the strings, what the string does is to shift the theta angle by 2 pi. And therefore, at the end of this process, the monopole and the anti-monopole pairs gain a net electric charge. So you can start with nothing. Pair creates a monopole anti-monopole pairs, bring them around the axion string, and then pair annihilates on the other side of the axion string, and you end up with a net electrically charged particle. But how is this consistent with the Gauss law? There's no Gauss law because the Gauss law equation is anomalous. And if there had been a Gauss law operator, it would lead to a contradiction because you can circle the original magnetic monopole. Originally, you get zero for the electric charge, but after it goes around the axion string, it suddenly gains one unit of electric charge. So this is just to say that there's no conserved and quantized electric charge in the presence of an axion. However, something is still conserved. In axion physics, you know, if you try to scatter two electrons, you're not going to get seven electrons. So even though the electric charge is not strictly conserved, its violation has a very fixed pattern. And the question is, can you explain this modified conservation law using a generalized global symmetry? And that's what the non-invertible symmetry is doing. And let me explain that. So we would like to define a gauge invariant Gauss law or Gauss operator. We follow the same strategy. You can start by just integrating star f over a surface, but you are not going to get a conserved quantity. Instead, we integrate star f shifted by certain topological term, theta dA. Now this integrand is formally conserved, but it's not gauge invariant. In fact, this quantity has a name. This integral is known as the page charge. I think this term was coined by Domvarov maybe 20 years ago. The claim of Finn for the page charge is that something formally conserved, but it's not gauge invariant. So how do we make progress? You can exponentiate the page charge, but that's not going to help you. However, when the coefficient here in the exponent is a rational number, we can cure the gauge non-invariance by coupling the Gauss surface to a 1 plus 1 dz n gauge theory. I'm not going to tell you elaborate on the details. It doesn't really matter. So phi and c are auxiliary fields that we introduce on the Gauss surface. They are the counterparts of the little a in the case of the in the QED case. The upshot is that you end up with this blue action that is gauge invariant and conserved. The price we pay, again, is that this is non-invertible. One way to see that it's non-invertible is to study how it acts on the charged object. If you have a charged one electron here, and you circle this non-invertible one-form symmetry, the one stands for the fact that it's a one-form symmetry. It's supported on a two-dimensional surface in our four-dimensional space-time. The way it acts on an electrically charged particle is just by a phase. So by only looking at this part of the diagram, you might be thinking that this d1 with a subscript p over n is just e to the 2 pi I p over n times the charge. However, that's not quite correct, because any expression of the form e to the 2 pi I p over n times q cannot admit the kernel. E to the something is always unitary, and in particular, invertible. But our D operator is non-invertible. If you circle it around a charge one monopole, it gives you zero. It's a multiplicative zero, not an additive zero. And that shows this operator has a kernel, and it's a non-invertible operator. Nonetheless, it gives interesting selection rules. The selection rules it gives is that in the presence of a magnetically charged object with magnetic charge n, the electric charge doesn't have to be strictly conserved, but it has to be conserved modulo n. And that's the more restricted modified conservation law we were looking for. And the upshot is that it's implemented by a non-invertible one-form symmetry. The corresponding Gauss law is what we call the non-invertible Gauss law. It's the statement that electric charge is conserved modulo n in the presence of a magnetically charged n monopole. Okay, so we have uncovered some interesting non-invertible symmetries in axiom physics. You can ask, apart from giving us a more coherent way to understand the conservation law, what else can we learn from it? There's one very nice universal inequalities you can derive from the non-invertible symmetry. Typically, this non-invertible symmetries are emergent in the low energy, as well as the higher form symmetry. And you can ask, as you go up in energy, at which energy scales will these symmetries be violated? For instance, if you have an electric one-form symmetry, it will be violated by a dynamical electron. In the low energy, the electron is heavy, you ignore it, you have an approximate one-form symmetry. But as you go to the energy scale of the electron, then the one-form symmetry is violated. It turns out that the generalized global symmetries of the axiom physics are quite intricate. And there's a hierarchy between the different kinds of symmetries. To say it in a rough sense, one symmetry might be subordinate to another symmetry in the sense that symmetry number one cannot exist without the existence of symmetry number two. In that case, as you go up in energy, you cannot break symmetry number two. You have to break symmetry number one first and then symmetry number two. Otherwise, it's just not compatible with the symmetry structure we have. And this leads to universal inequality between the various symmetry breaking scales. In particular, it gives the universal constraints on the scale of an electrically charged particle in any UV completion of the axion model versus the monopole mass and the string tension. All right, so let me summarize. In massless QED and QCD, we find non-invertible symmetries of this form. They are conserved and gauge invariant and lead to interesting selection rule and conservation law. To put it in a maximally offensive manner, we can say that the neutral pion decays because of this non-invertible global symmetry. And in the later second half of the talk, we talk about non-invertible Gauss law in axion Maxwell theory. And it leads to universal inequalities on the symmetry breaking scales. I'll end the talk here and thank you very much for the questions and your attention.